Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Recovery is a process. It takes time, it takes patience, it takes everything you got. My name is Andrea, and this is Adult Child. Welcome back to Adult Child, where we take a deep dive into the impact of growing up in a dysfunctional family. Ahoy, my dear shit shows. For any new listeners, my name is Andrea. I am a total and complete shit show and proud of it. And I am an adult child. And if you're wondering what the hell that is, allow me to tell you, an adult child is somebody who grew up in a dysfunctional family. So basically everybody whose unresolved childhood wounds surface and play out in adulthood, and not in the best of ways. Okay, let me tell you what these wounds look like. They look like people-pleasing, approval-seeking, codependency, an overdeveloped sense of responsibility, fear of abandonment or fear of enmeshment, take your pick, fear of people and authority figures, a tendency to be attracted to the emotionally unavailable, low self-esteem, highly judgmental of oneself and others. Basically, people who are just like totally crushing it. And so this is where we talk about what the hell to do about it. And we talk about serious shit, but we don't take ourselves too seriously. We curse here. You've been warned. I also make really weird facial expressions. I want to tell you this funny story that happened over the weekend. It's not really a story. It's a conversation that I was having with one of my friends. We were talking about, she was asking me if I receive a lot of like hate comments or hate emails, and I've received very little. Like there's been a few things, but the one thing I was telling her is that the one comment that I get all the time whenever I post clips of the podcast, like video clips, is I always get the comments that are like, what the fuck is going on with that girl's face? Because I can't, like, I don't know if it's my ADD or what it is, but I just make the weirdest facial expressions when I'm doing these interviews, and I'm moving around all the time. And so I always, whenever I post shit on Reddit, everyone's like, oh yeah, powerful quote, but what the hell is going on with that girl's face? And I want to respond back and be like, yeah, what the hell is going on with that girl's face? Oh Lord. So welcome aboard. And so I think that every single human being on this planet should be required to work the 12 steps, whether or not they even qualify for some sort of a 12-step program. I think that the world would be a much better place. AA saved my life. The 12 steps saved my life. To date, it has been the most effective way. It has had the most success compared to any other form of treating alcoholism. But I was also under this impression that the 12 steps was all I needed to fix me, that all of my problems would be solved by working the steps and continuing to work a program. Well, it turns out that that was like partially true, but that was at a time when I was under the belief that my problem was my alcoholism. And while that was the problem at the time, right, that was the problem du jour, as I later would learn, that that was just a symptom of the real problem, which was my underlying childhood trauma. And so because I was under this belief that like the 12 steps is all you need, when I found myself with multiple years in sobriety and continuing to, you know, make the same mistakes over and over and over, stay in these patterns, these toxic romantic relationships, and just not being able to figure out what the hell is wrong with me. I'm doing all the things that you're telling me to do. I'm doing it all. But here I am yet again. And so it was such a sigh of relief to learn what an adult child was. here's the deal. You know, the 12 steps, while they work magic, they weren't designed to treat trauma. But for us alcoholics and addicts, by working the 12 steps, by getting some stability, some sobriety under our belts, that then allows us to do the deeper work. So we're not only talking about this, the books and the 12 steps, we're also talking about IFS stuff like parts work. We're talking about grief. We're talking about many, many of things. So I wanted to give you the origin story of the 12 steps because I figured there's probably some people that are not familiar with it. So the 12 steps were influenced by the Oxford group. So this was a Christian group that was founded at Oxford University by a German-American evangelist named Frank Nathan Daniel Buchman. So the Oxford group believed in the principles of first century Christianity. So that is one Christian sharing with another, which kind of like sponsorship, right? One alcoholic helping another alcoholic. And so in November of 1934, Bill Wilson, he reconnected with an old friend named Ebby, and him and Bill and Ebby used to drink together. But Ebby got sober, and he said that he had gotten sober through the Oxford group. And so their philosophy was focused on these six principles. So these six principles were the basis of the 12 steps. They were performing self-inventory, admitted wrongs, making amends, using prayer and meditation, and carrying the message to others. So what do we have there? We have steps 4, 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12 were covered in those. And so Ebby's story hugely impacted Bill Wilson, but the problem was that Bill Wilson was not down with religion. However, he ended up having this spiritual experience, which he considered an epiphany, where he realized that recovery could be a spiritual experience without it being a religious one. Here's a quote from him. "It was only a matter of being willing to believe in a power greater than myself. Nothing more was required of me to make my beginnings." So Bill developed the 12 steps from the Oxford group principles and then worked the 12 steps with Dr. Bob. They did them all in one day, I'm pretty sure. And he stayed sober. And what was realized was that there was this power in one alcoholic helping another. That was the secret sauce. Okay, so let's get the damn show on the road. But first, let's talk about why you, yes, you need to damn the Join Shit Show, my online support community. And you especially do because, folks, the holidays are here. I put a post up in the Shit Show community to ask them any concerns that they have with the upcoming holidays. Based off the comments that people put in there, it seems like this is a rather stressful time of the year. And so it would seem likely that it is for you as well. So how do you get through that? You get through that by being with like-minded people who understand what it's like to navigate the holidays when your family is screwed up. So how about you damn the Join Shit Show? I promise you, this will be a for sure less painful holiday if you join this community. Okay, I'm not saying it's going to be an amazing holiday because you joined the Shit Show. I'm saying that it's going to be less painful. And it's going to be, and you're not going to feel alone. You have other people who get it and who are here and want to support you as we try to heal this shit. So how about you go damn the Join Shit Show for less than a dollar a day? Yeah, you heard me, less than a dollar a day. See the link in the show notes next. Give me a little follow on the Insta, on the TikTok, at Adult Show Pod. And last but not least, whatever you do, please give me a 5-star rating on Apple, on Spotify. Thank you. Love you all. All right, y'all, she's back. We have Arlena Allen, but also known as Arlena A.
Do you know it took me a year to get Alcoholics Anonymous to the AA World Services to approve my book and so that I could use the 12 steps? And so there's a little
Oh,
inside,
what
but
to
it,
be able to like just even include it in the writing?
I wanted their permission to use the 12 steps in my book, and it took a year.
Where is the, did you get a letter from them or you have it in here? Like,
It's
I
of
got
course.
approval.
Well, in the very beginning, there's sort of like a little blurb that you're required to put in the book
Oh,
saying
I see here.
it's like, yes, I got approval, but they don't necessarily endorse or blah, blah, blah.
So it took them like a year to get back to you or to give you the approval?
Both. I mean, so we were going back, I was going back and forth with their IP attorney. And it was just such a long process. I check in every like 6 weeks, a month, and thank you for your patience. And then like a month later, they'd reply back, thank you for your patience. We will get back to you as soon as possible. So this went on for just
You're like,
about
I'm really fucking patient.
a year. Finally, I started like calling. I was like, I gotta get this done. I wanted it to come out. So it's the 12-step guide for skeptics, clearing up common misconceptions of a passage. And I wanted it to come out for like sober October, no booze November, dry January, all that stuff. So I was like, let's get the show on the road.
Did they ask you to change anything?
There was just a couple of little tweaks. I use Bill W's full name, and they don't do that. So I changed that, and then there was just some minor things, and they didn't want me to use my last name. I was all cool. That's fine. So there we have it. It says Arlena A on the front of the book.
What were you going to do if they didn't give you approval? Still write it.
I don't know. I was so a couple of people had told me that they published the 12 steps citing the first edition, which is public domain.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, but I didn't want to do that. I just
Are
didn't
they
want
written
to.
differently?
No, it's the
No.
same. I just didn't want to do it because I didn't want to create any exposure, legal exposure for
Yeah.
myself.
Yeah.
And listen, you and I know how 12-step people are. We love to
Yes.
debate every little thing. I already know that there will be people who will criticize, and that's fine. But I didn't want it to be for something that was sort of like within the traditions.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Have you that makes me think. Have you ever come across the traditions as they apply to personal relationships?
I have not.
I'll have to send you this PDF. I go to a meeting on Friday nights. It's like a double winner meeting. So it's like they have it written out. And so if, for example, like tradition five is each relationship has one primary purpose to love each other and to serve as an expression of God's love. So they're all written in the concept of how they apply to a relationship. It's really interesting. It's really good shit.
I would be super eager to check that out.
Yeah, I was sharing at that, like, because I was reading through them and I was thinking we need like a version for like how to apply the traditions to personal relationships with people who are dysfunctional, because it's like you can't really like you
So
need like
people,
special caveats
yeah, apply to
when
people.
the other person doesn't abide by what's suggested. What the fuck do I do?
Seriously.
Okay, so it's been a while. I'm not gonna make you go through your whole story again, but I would like to just ask you to start here and just give my listeners a little recap. Reintroduce you to them, and I'll put your initial episode in the show notes. But why don't you share when you had the realization that your childhood screwed you up more than you thought it did?
Have mercy. Yeah. So I'm in a 12-step meeting. I'm like, how did I get here? So I guess I realized that my childhood screwed me up pretty early on. I bottomed out when I was 25 years old. And then that's when I found recovery. So I'm 56, so it's been a minute. And I felt like I had always knew there was something wrong with me, right? I had always felt broken. I had always felt kind of othered. I'd always felt different. Right. Like I grew up in a family where my mother's Mexican, dad is from Kentucky. So, when I'm with my Mexican family, I'm the white girl. And when I'm with my white family, I'm the Mexican girl. Right. And back in the day, even at school,
There really weren't a lot of kids like me. You know, if you heard the term biracial, it was typically for children that had a black parent and a white parent, right? You typically don't think of biracial as being, you know, half Mexican, but I had always felt kind of different. And there was a couple of things that happened to me early childhood that really kind of set the stage for all my childhood dysfunction. When I was 5 years old, I was sexually abused by a neighbor child for an ongoing period of time. And I grew up in the church, so I had always felt like I was supposed to be a good girl, but I knew that something bad was happening, and I couldn't negotiate that. You know, I was so young,
Yeah, of
right?
course. Did
Yeah.
you speak up?
No.
No.
No, but my mother saw it happening one time and she freaked the fuck out. And I think it was her reaction to it
That
that
made you feel so much shame.
shame, but I kind of felt like she hated me. You know, obviously she didn't, but I didn't know that. And it set the stage, Andrea, for me to seek my mother's love. It sort of put me on the path of needing,
Desperately vying for that.
yeah. Trying to win her back. And when I was 14 years old, my older sister had mental illness. We didn't know that that's what it was at the time, you know, back in the day. They just were like, oh, she's, you know,
Troubled.
trouble, right? And my mom pulled me aside one day, and I never seen my mother afraid. She was a very positive, very like kick ass, taking names kind of gal. She didn't mess around, but I had never seen her so vulnerable. And she pulled me aside and she's like, we need to stay close to your sister. And I don't even remember what she told me, but the vibe I got was, if you save your sister, then I will love you. She didn't say that. In my mind, I was like, oh, maybe if I can save my sister, then my mother will love me. So fast forward to now, it's like, it's so ingrained in me to try to want to rescue and save people. You know, I have more boundaries nowadays, but it really did a number on me when I was 14 years old, thinking it was a setup for failure. I was never going to be able to help my sister. But it created this weird dynamic in our family where I was trying to control her. It was
She
so,
older or younger?
she's 2 years older, and it was so painful. I love my sister, and it was so painful for me to watch her suffer. And so I tried all the ways to control. You know, I tried compassion and love, protectiveness, standing up for her, controlling her. And when things failed, as they did, I would get angry with her. And, you know, she was like the consummate victim. So she was the one that really kind of controlled the household.
How did that manifest? Like, was it always there or it came on a certain age for her?
She seemed okay when we were younger, but then she started getting bullied in elementary school. The other children were not kind to her. She was a little different. She was like a straight A student, but there was always something a little off about her to this day. And you know, now we're no contact because it was just our relationship had just gotten so dysfunctional and painful for both of us. It was just better that we.
How long has it been?
So my mother died 3 years ago, and it was about a year after that. So it's been a couple of years.
Has she been able to like function in life?
Barely. Barely. She's alone a lot. She lived with my mother until my mother passed away.
Man, that must have taken a toll on her.
You know, my mom had such a very positive attitude that she was like Pollyanna about everything. But
Like
when
toxic positivity.
a little bit, yeah, I could never bring my pain to my mom because she would want to skip over it and a little spiritual bypassing and oh, let's focus on the positive. She loved me. She couldn't watch me suffer. She just could never hold space for me. It was, you know, kind of hard for me, but over the years, I was able to just accept her, and she and I had a beautiful relationship in the end. And when she passed away, I was the one that took care of. She was only sick for 22 days.
Holy shit.
Yeah, she got cancer, and by the time they found it, she was
Ugh.
stage four. And she was like, "Well, like she wasn't even afraid. She was like,
Ugh.
I just hope it goes fast." And I slept by her bed every night, and I gave her all her medic. Listen, I'm an alcoholic drug addict, but I long-term recovery, right? I've been sober for 30 years, but I was. giving her liquid morphine and lorazepam, like all these really heavy medications. And it's funny to note, like, the little drug addict in me was like, huh, maybe we can sell some of those after she's gone. Just like weird shit.
Of
I was like,
course.
yeah, my, but it was like, like I stepped back, I'm like, wow, it's still there. Like, the addict is still alive and kicking. But if I can tell you a little story about how she passed.
Please.
So I had, and I'm going to cry, so I'll just warn you now. But I had just completed a hypnosis certification maybe 6 months prior. And she was getting close to the end of my Auntie Arlene. I have an Auntie Arlene. She came up from Mexico City to be with us those 22 days, right? And this, if she was getting close, and my aunt kept saying, oh, you should do hypnosis with her. Maybe you can help her release. And I was like, yeah. And after a particularly bad night, she looked, it was, she was getting close. My aunt, one morning, my aunt was like, okay, so how about you do it now? And I was like, oh shit, now? Like, I'm on the spot. Okay. So I was terrified. They left, and it was just me and my mom in this room.
Did she know that you were going to do it?
My aunt?
No, your mom.
No.
Oh,
No,
okay. She's knocked
she's
out.
out now. Yeah.
Yeah,
So
okay.
she's on liquid morphine. I hadn't opened her eyes in several days, and her breathing getting slower and ra more ragged. And so we knew we were close. And they, so when they left, and let me just set the scene, because it was November 3rd and it's in Idaho. So it's like a crisp fall morning, and she's in her room, and outside her window is like this lake, and the curtains are parted and the sun is shining on her face. And I start playing this really beautiful music, and there's like geese on the water outside, there's like the smoke on the water. And I just start separating her body from her spirit, right? Your spirit is getting lighter and lighter. Your body is getting heavier and heavier. Your heart is starting to stop. Your breathing is slowing. And I just kept talking to her, like, we're okay. Everybody, your job here is done. We're all safe. You're free to go. And as I was talking to her, my eyes were closed. I opened my eyes and I could see that it was working. Her breathing was changing dramatically, right? And I was like, oh my God, it's working. So I just kept talking to her. It's like, you are so loved. You're free to go. We're all safe and healthy. And as the music was playing, I heard the geese lift off the water. And when I opened my eyes, she was gone. And in the end, it was just me and her. And I was so grateful that I was the one that she trusted, because I was the problem child growing up. But I got recovery, and she trusted me. And it was probably like the single most precious moment of my life. And I'm so grateful to, that I was able to go through the process of getting sober and getting help, that I could be this woman for her. It was amazing.
Oh, it made me cry. Oh, man.
Sad. I miss her terribly. Girl, I was down for the count for about a year and a half. I was so sad. I'd never experienced grief like that, and I just kind of checked out of life for about a year and a half. And it wasn't it wasn't about until like the 18-month mark where I started feeling like myself again. Different, but I feel okay now.
Yeah, it's interesting. I just lost my cat, and I've never like I that was the first time I've really ever experienced like a deep loss, and she was 20. And it's still really hard. I got two other cats, but they'll never be as good as Kiki. She's my baby. I have her back in a second. So that's been interesting. Just I've always had so much fear about when that day would come, just because I was afraid of like what would come up that hasn't come up, that would be triggered by that grief, but
So unexpected.
just listening to you, like part of it is like I just think about like with my mom or and my parents, like there's already a grieving that's gone on because they're just so both deep in alcoholism, so it's like they've kind of already died in certain ways. But I also know that like there's certain things that I'm not going to be able to really grieve and process, until they're gone, just from talking to other people. I just think that there are certain things that we can't necessarily work through or grieve while they're still like living, but
very different.
Yeah, it's really sad, you know. It's really sad to like see both your parents die, like from this, especially as an only child too, you know. So yeah, that's why I'm in IFS, because I just think that there's still there's some carried shame that's still there that I've had a hard time working through for several years, you know. So I'm really feeling optimistic that this is gonna be helpful and what needs to happen. And I would have thought it was like absolutely nuts and weird like 2 years ago. And man, I mean, everyone in my community, like we are all on the IFS bandwagon. It really seems to be so effective for us adult children of alcoholic and dysfunctional families. It really, really hits the mark. When did you start doing it?
Very powerful. Probably started doing it. I saw a Tim Ferriss interview with Dick Schwartz, like mm-hmm. maybe 3 years ago, maybe it was even longer than that. And just super curious about the process. And so I've done it with a few different facilitators. Mm-hmm. And it's so interesting. It's almost like sponsorship, how like different sponsors bring something different to the table. Mm-hmm. Right. So some people, I find the best facilitators make you feel really safe and notice when you are really connecting with like the sadness, and they don't shy away from it. They sort of help you to lean in.
Yeah. And they can pick up on it. Like the woman, my IFS therapist, she's been doing it for a really, really, really long time. And we're on Zoom too, you know, and she can just pick up on like when I go into different parts, and she's really, I've really lucked out over the years with finding good therapists.
If you don't find somebody that you connect with, just keep trying is the message.
Yes. Yeah. And if you don't feel safe with that person, that's not a good sign.
I think that people like us are so sensitive to reading energy, because that's how we survived childhood. Yeah. Is very sensitive. Like we've developed like this sixth sense. Mm-hmm. So if a facilitator has not done their own work, mm-hmm. they get triggered while facilitating, and we can feel it, and mm-hmm. it ends up feeling like we're not safe, right? Because it's difficult to trust somebody who is actively sort of dysregulated.
Oh, absolutely. Okay, so let's like circle back. Okay. So those things happened in your childhood. So then was there a particular point in your sobriety where you were like, I have to start looking at this?
You know, what's so funny is you would think that, you know, like I was sober for quite a while before I started dealing with what happened to me as a child, because there was a part of me that just normalized it. And I didn't realize until being in therapy for a while that that's actually pretty common. Mm-hmm. You think that the experiences that you had as a child are normal, and so you don't recognize it as trauma. So it took me a while to sort of really get in touch with all the trauma that happened to me. And so IFS has been super helpful, but it wasn't, you know, I started out doing something called process therapy, which was sort of similar to IFS because it was all about parts work. I did.
How was it different?
So in IFS, they ask you to, you know, think about a situation. Where are you feeling it in your body? Mm-hmm. How do you feel towards that part? And, you know, then that's when the protector is typically introduced. And so you ask that protector for permission to address what's going on underneath. And there's a, you know, that's the exile. So there's a process of bringing the exile, you know, unburdening them and bringing them home and retrieving them and all that stuff. And so that's a definite process. Process therapy was so interesting because I would talk to her about what was going on with me. And then she'd ask me to close my eyes and scan my body and then give the feeling a color or a shape. And it was a process of like kind of talking to that and going through this. I keep using this word process, but I would feel the feelings to resolution of what was happening. And that was part of my problem, is that I was unable to process feelings to resolution. My coping strategy for dealing with uncomfortable feelings was typically like to distract or suppress, avoid. And
Mm-hmm.
right in my mind, the purpose of addiction is distraction, distraction from that pain that we
Yeah.
don't have the skill set to resolve,
Mm-hmm.
right? So anyway, they were slightly different processes, and I really like IFS because it is there's a few facets to it. One of the processes of IFS that I am currently obsessed with is this idea of polarized parts, right? So there, it shows up when people feel stuck in long-term sobriety, creating this program called the Inner Compass Program, because I'm like, this is going to be the work that allows you to do all your other work, right? Like the only thing I've ever done in moderation is recovery work. It's like we lack of information is not the problem. We all know what it is that we're supposed to be doing, but we don't do it. And why is that? We have these competing needs. There's a part of us that wants to do the work. We want to reach our goals. We want to be seen. We want to be heard. But then we have these other parts that need to be safe, especially if you grew up in an environment where it wasn't safe to be seen or heard. Like being seen or heard meant that you got hurt, right? So we have these polarized parts, and it shows up as internal resistance. So you're supposed to go to the gym, you're supposed to meditate, you're supposed to do your step work, blah, 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 all these things you're supposed to do. And you're like, well, let me just check my email first. Let me just do this other thing first, and we distract, distract, distract. And then at the end of the day, we're like, fuck, I didn't do the thing.
Yeah, story of my life.
Yeah. So I created this worksheet that you can download for free at innercompassprogram.com. And it's a journaling exercise to start working with your polarized parts so that they can negotiate, get their needs met, so that you can operate from your higher self and get shit done.
That's so cool. Why do you say that that is a common issue with those with long-term sobriety?
I think you've seen it. In the rooms, we talk about playing whack-a-mole with our character defects. It seems like they show up in one of three categories. There's the big three. There's romance, finance, and fitness, right? And so usually these are all polarized parts, things that we want desperately and are just unable to do it, right? And so we get really frustrated. We think, oh, I'm not turning. I had a gal come to me recently for coaching, and she wanted to get sober. And I was like, why, what have you tried in the past? Why do you think you haven't been able to do it? And it was all, I keep taking my will back. I'm not disciplined enough. It was all self-blame. And I was like, it kind of broke my heart. I was like, oh, that's not actually what's happening. What's happening is that you have competing needs. You have polarized parts. There's a part of you that really wants to get sober and do the work. And there's a part of you that knows, like, the best p predictor of future behavior is past behavior. It's this need for survival. And so when she bumps up against this, her comfort zone, I feel like our comfort zone, it's like we live in this little space. It's like we have this internal thermostat. We don't get too high, we don't get too low. We sort of find this comfort zone that we live in. And in my mind, the borders are your polarized parts. And so she starts getting close to her goal, and then this other part comes in and sabotages her progress. It's this part that doesn't feel safe being this new identity, like her new sober identity. And so this other part that she really doesn't have any control over because it's subconscious, kind of, she self-sabotages. And we see this all the time. We see it in the rooms of people who relapse a lot. We see it, people in relationships. We just see it all the time. And so in my mind, I go, oh, it's not strategies and tactics that we need. It's not more information we need. It's we need to resolve this internal resistance. That is the work that allows you to do all your other work so
Well,
that
to
you.
me, I would just say that's trauma. And that's what being an adult child is, right? Like, for me, I feel like that's what it is. It's like all this stuff that comes up later in sobriety, like when we have time under our belt, right? I feel like that's like describing the condition of being an adult child, right?
Yeah, I mean, you don't have to have trauma to experience that dynamic,
You don't think so? I mean, I think we all do.
Oh, yeah. Listen, I know plenty of well-adjusted people who cannot manage their money, who have terrible relationships. doesn't mean that they necessarily have trauma.
I disagree. I think we all do. I really do. Little t trauma. Maybe not big things, but I
I believe
do. I really do think that it's all rooted in that, you know?
life is
And
hard, right? Like it's
yeah.
divorce and adulthood, very traumatic.
Because I would think, I mean, ultimately, I think that that's what it is, right? It's the deeper causes and conditions that come to the surface, like as we gain more sobriety, which is all of the stuff that we ingrained and internalized during our childhood, like during our upbringing, or that we inherited. I think the other thing too that's interesting about like what I've noticed with like polarized parts. And what's been interesting with like IFS is that sometimes the reason that you might think a particular part is doing something, like what makes the most sense on the surface, could actually turn out like not to be it, because what it actually is something that doesn't necessarily make sense, but it's because it's rooted in like a younger version of ourselves, you know?
Yeah, the younger version of ourselves is not really tied to logic.
Mm-mm. Mm-mm.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, that's just my opinion. It's like, I really do all think it comes back to like little t trauma and everything that we ingrained, and it just comes up. And that's why we have to do the deeper work. So I think that that is absolutely true. And that is why people like go back out, is because we have to do that deeper excavating, you know?
And I think that, a lot of people, so it's important to understand why, like why we are the way we are. But once you kind of understand why we are the way we are, we need to move past like the information gathering stage and get into action. And a lot of times what keeps people from taking action are these polarized parts. And I feel like we had a really good way to deal with that. There are other modalities that help people. I was really attracted to hypnosis because I knew it was a way to sort of, get to the subconscious limiting beliefs and reframing those, especially those. I actually went to a hypnotherapist to deal with some of that when my father passed away, to deal with some of the, I didn't know that I was going there for that. I thought I was going to go there to be more confident, or I was like, what is it about me that isn't able to finish this book or whatever? And it turns out that I ended up, reframing, going into my past and reframing a lot of experiences that I had around my dad, because he was like the critical parent. He was kind, but his way of expressing love was to help me become a critical thinker. And so he was always the devil's advocate. He's always playing devil's advocate. So it left me. Actually, what created it was this inner critic, right? Like I was always doubting myself, always questioning, and just I never felt like he was on my side, so I felt alone and alienated, which kind of seems to be like a reoccurring theme. But it was such a profound. I was able to process a lot of those feelings to resolution, and it was so powerful for me that that's when I went and got certified to do hypnosis, because there's many ways to sort of get to the root cause, but it all just stems from childhood experiences for sure.
I was thinking when you said that, made the comment about how it took you a while to realize that it was trauma because it was like normalized. I think too, it's like it also depends upon like what we have going on in our life that would cause those things to be triggered, you know? And so I was thinking about with you, like you got married that pretty early in sobriety, right? Or you started dating him pretty early on.
We started dating when I was about 5 months sober, and then we got married after I was about 3 years sober.
I'm just thinking about like like everything that came up for me just like in trying to date, you know? Good
I know that we're sort of, it's been 30 years.
for you. It's amazing.
Outlier, but we
Lucked out.
did together this whole time is that we both practiced the 4-step. Whenever something came up in our relationship,
I'd go to my sponsor and I'd be like, I read about this in the book. I'm like, Bobby did this and Bobby did that. And my sponsor, Julie, would be like, okay, well, I don't sponsor him. Talk about you. And I was like, oh, bitch. Like, I wanted her, I was like coming to her like for validation. I wanted her to co-sign my bullshit. She wasn't having none of it. She was like, well, she was compassionate, but when you're new and you just want validation, like, I didn't know that that's what I
Like,
wanted.
call your friend, not me.
Yeah, but she was kind though. She would first start off with like, well, did you just want to vent? Did you just want me to hear you? Do you want feedback? What is it that you want from me? And I was like, oh my God, nobody has ever asked me that before. And so of course I wanted to know what she thought. And she was like, well, let's talk about your part. Let's take you through the 4-step process. What specifically happened? Let's get really clear. 'Cause in my, I'd be like, he did this, and he did that, and blah, blah, blah. She's like, oh, no. Let's get really specific about the cause. And then let's get really specific about how you were affected. And most of the time, it was like it affected my emotional security, my relationship with him, like that personal, my self-esteem was always at stake. My self-esteem was always taking a hit because at the end of the day, it was all my fault anyway, right? Like in the back of my mind. But like those processes were happening so fast, like I didn't recognize. And that's what I loved about the steps. It's like it's a mechanical way of deconstructing so that I could see. And ultimately, I was like, oh, he wasn't being a dick. He was reacting to my fear because he would do something. I would get afraid and do or say something. And then he would react to that. But I didn't see any of my part. I was like, wow, he is such a dick. And my sponsor was like, oh, no. That's not, but it, she got me to the place where she would help, she would talk me through it till I got to the place of empathy for him, where I could see how my behavior affected him. And then I could go back to him and be like, oh, I see now how me doing this and that must have affected you. Not only am I sorry, I think apologies are important, but what can I do to make it right? And if you need a minute to think about it, because I've done all my processing, I'm just laying this on his lap. He hasn't had a chance to process. I was like, if you need a minute to think about it, you can get back to me later. You don't have to respond right in the moment. Right. Meanwhile, he was going off to the fellas and doing the same thing. So together. So I feel like that's what's helped us to, stay together. And we have a really great relationship. I feel super lucky to have him.
What has been one of the most difficult struggles that you guys have had to like work through? Was there something that took a while, like as far as I don't know, in particular, something that was a theme?
Okay, shit show dudes, you can tune out. This is for my fellow shit show ladies. Are you going through perimenopause or menopause? I'm not quite there yet, but I know that I have plenty to look forward to. Feeling like a wet sock driving down the highway, night sweats, poor sleep, feeling tired all the time, bloating, gas. Man, can't wait for this shit. Now, if that is applicable to you, then you have to try Hormone Harmony. So Hormone Harmony is not just a supplement for women going through perimenopause, menopause, or postmenopause. It's become a phenomenon. Women cannot stop talking about it. A bottle of Hormone Harmony is sold every 24 fucking seconds, okay? Now, Happy Mammoth, the company that created Hormone Harmony, is dedicated to making women's lives easier using only science-backed ingredients that have been proven to work. Now, for my younger shit show women like myself, if you struggle from that vicious week before your period, you want to crawl out of your skin, experience cravings, want to eat everything in the damn house, you feel a little bit down or off, well, Happy Mammoth also has a product for you to make it easier to manage your PMS with their Estro Control. So for a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code adultchild at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code adultchild for 15% off today.
Do you shit shows ever feel like you're just too damn busy to eat healthy? So I used to feel this way. Every day I would wake up with the intention of eating clean, and before you know it, it's 10:30 p.m., I'm in my bed, and I'm eating smart food popcorn. That is, until I found the perfect solution. Meal kits from Sunbasket. No matter what your lifestyle is, Sunbasket caters to your kind of healthy. Every single recipe is shit show proof, so pre-measured, pre-proportioned, easy to prepare. I most recently made
the seared Alaskan halibut with mashed potatoes and herb brown butter parmesan sauce, and it was damn good. And for you shit shows out there who only know how to work a microwave, Sunbasket also has pre-made meals that are ready to eat in less than 5 minutes. No prep, no mess. So go to sunbasket.com/adultchild today to save $120 off your first four deliveries. That is sunbasket.com/adultchild to save $120 across your first four deliveries, plus free shipping on your very first order.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I mean, in the beginning, it was around money. Money was a real hot topic for us because I was like super controlling and tight with money, and he was really frivolous. Bless his heart. He was very generous. And so that was often a point of contention because we had like competing ideas of what was important. Like to me, money meant safety, and for him, spending money meant connection. Mm-hmm. And happiness and stuff. So we had to come to, my sponsor was finally like, you know what, Arlena, this is his life too. And if that's how he wants to spend his money, that's his business. Mm-hmm. You have no right to tell him how to spend his money. And if this is if you want furniture, fucking save up and get some furniture. If that's what you want, he doesn't want that shit. So you have no right to put this on him. Like it's his responsibility to make you happy. And that's kind of what it came down to, is who is responsible for my happiness? It's me. Right. And so, you know, thank God for the steps and the process, because that's kind of what has helped us. Yeah. So, and then the other thing probably later on is when one of my boys was having issues around drugs, We were both really afraid, and so we had competing different ideas about what should happen. So that was really hard too, but we worked through that. Everyone's fine now.
Yeah. What was that experience like as a mom?
They're terrifying. It was terrifying. You know, when you have kids, I remember reading this thing that says when you have kids, you're agreeing to have your heart walk around outside your body. Mm-hmm. You know, just so vulnerable. And when you can't protect your child from themselves, that is terrifying.
Yeah. Did you start working Al-Anon hard then?
No, I've never been able to submit to Al-Anon. It was too, so to me, this is my own bullshit, but the tone of Al-Anon there's like an undertone of victimhood.
Yeah, I can say that. Yeah, I agree.
My sister was the consummate victim. So everything inside me rails against that sort of mentality. Mm-hmm. And I just didn't feel comfortable there. I couldn't feel safe enough to get to my issues. But listen, I have tons of other tools and lots of different modalities for addressing that stuff. And we were all able to get through that period of time safely.
Yeah, I've definitely had that experience as well. It's hard to find good meetings. And the same thing goes with ACA, which is like why I started my community, just because I felt like it was a lot of like doom and gloom. Yeah. So I totally hear that. So why did you want to write this book? What's the backstory?
So it's kind of funny. I actually didn't want to write this book, but people kept coming onto my podcast. And, you know, the first half of is that they tell their story. And the second half, we talk about solutions, because I want people to be able to walk away with some solutions. And, you know, I respect that there are many paths to recovery. I'm not one of those people who thinks this way is the only way. I just think it's a worthy endeavor. There's no reason not to do it. Right. I understand that there are some barriers, but that was what the whole book was about. It's like, you know, the top three trigger words, God, alcoholic, and powerlessness. Like those are three words that immediately people at first glance go, nope. They, without context and perspective, they wholly toss out an entire program without understanding that those do not need to be barriers to entry. Like there's a way around mm-hmm. all those things. Because the hill I will die on is the 12 steps are a worthy endeavor. And you can access them through Smart Recovery, Celebrate Recovery. There's like a bunch of different ways to get to it. So that's really all I'm saying. But these people would come on my podcast and they'd be like, I always pre-screen and say, if you're 12 step or are you 12 step oriented? Because some people don't want to, they're sensitive about that because some of the traditions are confusing to people. They don't understand that it's anonymity, not secrecy, right? You don't have to claim your membership, right? Like that's kind of how I get around is I don't claim membership to any specific 12 step group. So, but when people say, no, I didn't do that, I couldn't help it. I'd have to ask why. And I have yet to hear a valid reason. I'll just say it. I don't typically like to invalidate people's feelings, but people will be like, oh, well, I don't believe in God. I'm all cool. That's not a thing. Mm-hmm. That's not a thing. You could totally do the 12 steps and not believe in God. So it was stuff like that that kept coming up. I was like, I just have to. And the other thing that kept coming up for me was, you know, AA's public relation policy is about attraction, not promotion. So there is nobody saying, no, there's nobody to set the record straight, right? To offer context and perspective around challenging ideas, right? And so that was kind of the point of the book. I was saying things like, hey, you know what? The steps and meetings are two separate things. Meetings are not the program. The steps are. And so people will go to meetings and they either don't like what somebody said, or maybe it's an unhealthy group or whatever. Maybe the group is not rooted in the actual literature. Mm-hmm. That's a big thing. I advocate that people read the literature for themselves and they walk away. They go, oh, I don't like that. I don't like that program. What they're saying is I don't like that meeting. They don't understand that the steps are the program.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of separate. So I'm trying to separate some things out so that and offer context and perspective to clear up a lot of the misinformation that's being promoted on social media by people who don't really know what they're talking about.
Is there a lot of that's surprising to me. I don't really come across it that much, but you probably get exposed to it a lot more. Is there a lot of backlash?
A lot of backlash.
Really?
There's straight up vitriol against AA specifically. I've had people attack me on social media, so I have learned. So this book is not for people who are closed-minded. And by that, I'm saying if you are so hurt, had such a bad experience that you're so hurt, first of all, I am so sorry that that happened to you, but some people just close their minds and they just are so hurt. They can't get past it. I've had a lot of people who were like children of parents that were alcoholic that were like, my mom tried to go to Alcoholics Anonymous and, it never worked for her. And they maybe went to meetings when they were kids and just had such a bad impression that they just can't get past it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Or a bad experience with religion. Mm-hmm. And so they think that AA is religious. That's a very common misconception. Right? It's not religious. It's spiritual. It's not based. Yes, if you are a Christian, then it will be easier for you to accept because there are some undertones of Christianity in there. But it's a take what you like, leave the rest kind of a
100%. With people. Yeah. And it really depends too on which meetings you go to can make a big difference, or the part of the country that you're in, that can also make such a big difference. For me, it's so hard because I went to my first meeting at 12 and I was then going for myself, starting at the age of 14. So it's it's just always been there. I've never had an issue or felt any sort of shame in labeling myself as an alcoholic. And I really don't like that I don't like that we act like there's a stigma to the word when I personally don't think there is. And I understand that I'm an outlier. I don't know.
Not really, because there are people who get it. So one of the ideas in the book is this idea of redefining what words mean. And that is I introduced that when we talk about God. What is God? Well, when I first got sober, I had a bunch of religious trauma, and I was talking with this gal. There was nothing else available when I was 25 years old. There was nothing else. And so I was so desperate to be sober. I was like, fine, I'll go to these meetings. But they kept talking about God. And I was like, if this is what this is, I'm not going to be able to do it. And this gal pulled me aside and she was like, well, let's try this. She handed me a piece of paper and she said, on one side of the paper, write down, if you could, just like play along, write down all the characteristics that you would want God to be, all the positive characteristics. So I did that. And she's like, okay, on the other side, write down everything that you don't want it to be. So I did that. And when I was done, I handed her the piece of paper and she tore it down the half. She tore it down the center and handed me the positive side. And she's like,
She's like, there's your God.
start with this. And I was like, that's it. She's like, that's it. And I was like, oh my God, I didn't know you could do that. I didn't know you could redefine words, because I grew up in the religious parlance of this is the way it is, and you have to accept it in its entirety as prescribed. Like, and so she was like, no, you don't have to do that. So I was like, holy fuck. So anyway, that sort of encouraged me. Like, I knew to my core that I was an alcoholic. I had all the evidence I needed, so I didn't have a problem with the word. But I have come to understand, like, when someone says that they're an alcoholic, I know several things about them immediately. This is a person that struggled like I did, that they have a tremendous amount of courage. Because to be an alcoholic and be sober requires you to do the type of self-reflection that most people run from. It takes a tremendous amount of courage to be able to suit up and show up and do the work. So I have a huge amount of respect for some. So the word is a badge of honor to me. It has completely
I feel the same way. I don't have an issue with it.
changed.
But a lot
You're
of people do. And
lacking context and perspective is what's happening. In my mind, the words aren't as important as having somebody learn how to do self-reflection and process their feelings to resolution and find peace.
I'm curious, what do you say? Like, when somebody asks me, like, what do I think an alcoholic is? I say it's not that every time I drink, something bad happens, but every time something bad happens, I was drinking. Or if I take one, I have one drink, I can't tell you if I'm going to have two or I'm going to have 20. Do you have a definition for yourself personally?
I mean, not really. Like, listen, nobody's asking me what my definition
I was
is.
just curious.
Nobody asks me that. But yeah, I mean, it just sort of depends. Like, it's when I lost the ability to control my drinking. It's when everything else that I used to love loses its luster in my life. It's like drinking becomes the only thing I'm interested in. It's like that obsession takes over my life, and my whole life revolves around that.
Yeah, and I think that a binge drinker can be, just as much as an alcoholic as somebody who drinks every day too.
Yeah, I was a
So
binge drinker. I didn't drink every day.
it's interesting. Just I was sharing about this in a meeting that I went to lately, just thinking about how my views have shifted in 16 years, just about how I feel about alcoholism and how I feel about AA. Like when I first got sober, I really thought that this was, I don't know if I would say that this was the only way to get sober, but like kinda. And I also was kind of under the mindset of like, the only way this wouldn't work for somebody is because they aren't willing enough. And I do not believe that to be true today at all. I don't think that that's the case. And I look at like my mom, for example, and I think that for it's her unresolved trauma. And like what you said in the book, I completely am on board with you about how, yeah, that recovery allows you to stabilize enough to be able to deal with your trauma. And that 100% was my experience. I think there are certain people like that are habitual relapsers that it's almost something that ha I think it is what prevents them from being able to accumulate some time. I think sometimes that has to be kind of dealt with earlier on. And I feel like that's why my mom has not been able to maintain any, get any sort of like significant time together is because of never addressing that stuff, you know?
She's never done trauma therapy before.
She's gone to therapy, but like again, it's like people don't realize that they have trauma. People don't think
Therapy is
that what
sort
they
of
experienced is trauma, but it is.
just like this generic word, right? And it depend it matters what kind of therapy. Like some people can sit in CBT therapy for decades and just keep ruminating, like really not make any progress.
Oh, yeah. And you don't, a lot of therapists aren't knowledgeable. And the story of so many of us, we were in therapy for years with, the therapist not being able to point out what the actual issue is. So, like, you're not getting any better. And you start to think, wow, I'm inherently flawed and unfixable. What the hell is wrong with me?
Yeah, that's so sad.
The other thing that I really liked that you talked about was, because this is the other thing at gripe I've had about, when you talk about, anger, and I was thinking about in is it the fourth or the fifth step where it says like it's a dubious luxury that we've lost the, and it's like no, like hanging on to sitting with anger is, but not feeling anger. Like anger is a normal emotion that every single human being will feel. It's sitting in that anger that is dangerous for an alcoholic.
Yeah, it was interesting because when this book was written, I think Bill was like 5 months sober, and this was like 1935. So they didn't, it's not a perfect book. We have a lot more information now than we did then.
A ton.
I don't like this idea that's perpetuated that it's almost like we're not allowed to be angry. And I agree with you that it's about not sitting in the anger, but anger is a secondary emotion, typically underneath is some kind of sadness. But anger is a lot easier to feel than sadness or powerlessness and all those kinds of feelings. So it's so interesting how we can skip so quickly from hurt to angry. And even the anger, the truth will set you free, but first it will piss you off. I've learned that, being triggered is actually a good thing. Like we, sometimes, people want to, you're triggering me as if it's a bad thing, but there is something going on deeper. And it's actually a sign that there is like this wound of sadness that needs to be, treated with kindness and empathy and compassion. So, and that's what takes a lot of people out of the rooms. It's like they get angry at like the old timers or a controlling sponsor or somebody did something and they end up leaving. But it's like, oh, that was a missed opportunity. That's throwing the baby out with the bathwater. It's if you could just sit with the feeling and go through the process of the self-reflection and deconstructing what actually happened. There is a tremendous amount of healing that can happen by using the anger, not dwelling.
Yeah, it's so true. I posted a reel on Instagram yesterday that said, when someone says to me, you're not healed, you're just isolated with no one to trigger you. And this one girl like wrote a comment. It was like really long. It was like, I don't need somebody to tell me that I'm not triggered. And then I responded to her. I said, tell me you're triggered without telling me that you're triggered. I think she liked it, so I think she knew I was calling her out.
Yeah, but it's nice to have people who will help you process to resolution. And yeah, it's not a bad thing. I had this a long time ago. I used to listen to Marianne Williamson a lot, and she would lecture on the Course in Miracles, and she would talk about, we're sort of in this life classroom, and she would use this illustration of a gemologist will take two raw amethysts and put them in a tumbler together. And the amethyst, two like stones, will rub each as they're being tumbled, they rub off their rough edges so that when they come out, they're smooth. I'm like, that's exactly what's happening to us when we go to meetings. We get mixed through the tumbler with all these people. And, if you submit to the process of like self-examination, you learn something about yourself and you don't get as triggered the next time. You're able to respond, not react. You can take a pause and you change. And that's really the whole point. But in isolation, that shit doesn't happen. So it's actually, while sometimes, meetings get a bad rap, I think they're really important because, I mean, meetings and the steps are like soap and water. They kind of work better if you use them together. So that's kind of
100%. What did anything come up for you while writing this book? Like, did you have any, I don't know, insights or ahas or anything get re-triggered through writing it?
I wouldn't say re-triggered, but I did have an experience of flow. When, you know, it was, you know, it's hard to sort of like dig up your past and relive it. And, you know, I'm trying to, you know, speak in a clear way with compassion. The first version of the book was so angry, you know, because anyway, and so I had a developmental editor be like, who is this for? She's like, it's good that you got your anger out, but now let's write it with love and compassion. And so I try to do that, but it was hard. But there was this one day when I was writing, and I was writing about recovery resistance, right? Like, what is it that like repels people from the program? And this whole
specifically from 12 steps, or just getting any sort of recovery in general?
I would say any recovery in general, you know. But you know, I'm writing about the 12 steps, and you know, I'm a person that got something really great out of it. I could stand shoulder to shoulder, witness a scene with somebody else, and they're like, no, I'm not going to do this. It's like, what is the difference between us? And it comes down to our belief systems, right? And limiting beliefs, I would argue that if you're not able to submit to the 12 steps, you have limiting beliefs. And I realize that that's kind of confrontational, but the idea of a limiting belief is that we're either lacking information or the information we have is incorrect, right? And it's not a moral thing, right? It's just a statement of fact. Like, beliefs aren't necessarily rooted in truth. A belief is an idea that's been repeated so that it becomes accepted as the truth. Like, as a little kid, if you're told you're stupid all the time, you begin to believe that. And you grew up to be an adult who can manage high stress environments. You can be a high achiever, but you have this internal belief. Like, sometimes people are so compelled to be achievement oriented because they're fighting against this idea that I'm stupid, right? It's not true. We have evidence that it's not true, but it's a belief. So it's incorrect. And so I feel like a lot of recovery resistance is we are afraid. And so we attach to something, an excuse, let's just call it an excuse. And we say, I'm not going to do this because of this reason. And we bail. But that is a way of avoiding the work that needs to be done. It's your own, the system is designed to defend the system. So you have a survival system that has helped you to survive, but it's no longer working for you. It's like our survival skills don't translate to healthy adult skills. And so we have problems. And so the idea is that we go back to the presupposition to determine whether it's incorrect or incomplete. That's all. It doesn't mean that you're a bad person. It doesn't mean that you're stupid. People get very defensive, but that is sort of like the nature of recovery resistance. It's like this fear that maybe I am stupid. And so we resist doing the work. And it also goes back, in my mind, it goes back to the polarized parts, right? There's a part of us that wants to get healthy. There's a part of us that wants to stay small so that we can stay safe. It's typically rooted in safety. So it was trippy to write. I just experienced flow as I was writing that part. And then now it has become something that I'm super obsessed with because I'm like, you know what, get sober. And then in long-term recovery, if you find yourself in like the cybernetic loop of repeating negative patterns and you don't feel like you can break out of it, then come do this process and break out, like do the polarized parts work. There's many other modules around, you know, reshaping, identifying, reshaping, limiting beliefs, creating a new identity. But it's sort of what's necessary after the crisis of addiction has been averted.
What, I think a lot when you were saying that people leave, they blame it, have an excuse for a reason, when it's really rooted in this fear. But I think a lot of people aren't able to see that that's actually what's going on. Right. So it's like, so talk about some of your polarized parts that you've been battling with.
What's so interesting, writing the book is one of the ways that I came across this work, because there was a part of me that really felt the need, like I felt compelled to write this book. I absolutely felt compelled to write it. But there were times when I would put it down for like a month at a time. You know, maybe something happened and I was like, I just can't. And I would just put it down. And that was an example. It's like, so when I was young, I desperately wanted to be seen by my mom. But on the other hand, sometimes when I got seen, like my mom had some rage issues when I was young, like she grew out of it. But it's this fear of like, I want to be seen, but I'm afraid to be seen. Like I want to be safe. And it showed up in the writing process. It has shown up in my career in many different ways. I still want to be heard. I have a freaking podcast, but I do it from my little bubble. My little office bubble where I'm safe, and I shout out into the void, right? Like I know people are listening because of the download numbers and stuff, but isn't it interesting? It's like I so desperately, and I want to help people, right? This came from my need for, trying to help my sister, right? So it's just funny, but it's also if I put my self-esteem based on somebody else's progress, it's a setup for failure, right? So I do have like pretty healthy fear of success, fear of being seen, that type of thing. So I do my own polarized parts work because I want to make progress. And I feel like, especially in this political climate, it's like women really need to maybe we can use this for leverage to actually do the work. We need to be financially independent. We always do, right? But we need to, it's motivation to really take responsibility for your feelings and your experiences in life.
Absolutely. I was wondering, like, the when you made the comment about your first the first cut version being really angry and kind of trying, what was, sorry, there's this really construction going on out there. I don't know if you can hear it. Because it is kind of part of it is like you have these people coming on that you feel don't have an accurate perception. And so there's almost like this part of you that like feels the need to defend and like convince. And so like trying to like, make sure that the process of making sure it's not rooted in that entry, in that energy, and just was that kind of an interesting process for you?
Girl, I wrote a piece that was so good. I was
Probably felt so good too.
slamming. There's a couple of personalities out there who openly criticize. One of them wrote, I'm not even going to say her name, but I don't think I'm allowed, but wrote a piece for Time magazine, like quote unquote debunking
Oh,
AA.
I think I remember that. I think I remember that. Was it like, yeah, I think that, yeah, that was like a couple years ago.
Was a while
Was it
ago.
calling it like a, were they, yeah, they were saying, yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, so just talking out of her neck, basically. It was not rooted in any kind of truth. It was all misinformation, basically. But they're young, pretty, t really talented writers. And I was like, they are like the Pied Piper leading people off a cliff because they are saying, don't do this thing and not really having a sufficient substitute. I'm not saying it's the only way to get sober, but if you're going to tell people not to do that, you should
Yeah,
really.
give them other ideas.
Yeah, there really should be. But it was like largely untested methodologies that was really concerning to me. And it just
So what,
pissed.
you had written a piece that in response to that, you mean?
It was, yeah, the first draft was really, and it was so good. I was. When the lady read it, she was like, "You sound angry. You sound defensive." And that's one of my criticisms of this gal, is that she's so angry. Like all her content is so angry, and there's a lot of women that really resonate with that anger. There's a lot of pissed off women out there that are really struggling with the patriarchal society. And but if we're going to live in a victim mentality, you'll never get what you want. Like I'm about empowering women, and I don't think anger is the way to do it. Maybe you can leverage some of that to get yourself motivated, but anger and fear is a dirty fuel source because you do the work and then the pain is alleviated, and what are you going to use to stay motivated, right? And then your brain has something called the default mode network, right? Like your brain develops in a certain kind of way. And when you stop doing the work of recovery, your brain goes back to default. It's not unlike, you could go to the gym for a year, but if you stop working out, your body goes back to factory setting, right? So everybody understands that if you want to stay in shape, you got to keep working out, right? So if you stop doing, so if your dirty fuel source dries up, you will go back to your old ways of being. So it's more, I feel like it's just more creative and more sustainable to come from a place of love. And that's, I got my anger out in the first drafts of the book. And then I decided to, I had to rewrite the whole damn thing. And it's more from a place of empathy and compassion, a place of love, because I really feel like that is what is sustainable, not the fear.
Yeah, it's something I've talked about with like several, hi Tucker, with several guests is that what you were saying about like all they do is post, it's not just like women, it's just I find it like in the healing space in general, and like especially like with trauma, that people, like the accounts that are always bashing other people or blaming, they get so much attention and they do well because that feels good, the self-righteousness of it, right? And I do think that there's like an element of maybe initially that's how we first start to maybe identify a little bit and crack open the door. But when it's that 100% of the time, there is no self-reflection. It is always what the other person did or, you know, this and that. It's just, it's so unhealthy and just creates more of it.
And we really need to... everything boils down to kind of love or fear. That was kind of the message of A Course in Miracles. And I recognize that fear is not sustainable. It's not something I want to create from. And so, you know, I'm not even bashing the fear. I'm like, okay, well, I guess you can use it, you know, but ultimately we need to grow out of it. Right. So
hopefully a lot of people won't.
You don't have to, like, you know, do you, boo?
I suggest you do though.
To you, but it's interesting because that has, you know, social media has divided our country because it, you know, they learn through the algorithms that people are more, you know, it used to be sex sells, now it's anger.
Yeah, I know, it's so sick and disgusting.
It is. I say that we will, you know, the pendulum will swing. I really do. Mm-hmm. I think we'll get tired of it, and it could take some time, but there is a movement happening where people are trying to come from this place of love. Sounds kind of cheesy, but that's what's sustainable.
So you have this inner, what'd you call it? Inner Compass program.
Yeah.
When's that start?
It starts in January, but in the meantime, people can download a worksheet and just get started.
Okay. What else do you have going on and want to share about?
I mean,
the book, obviously.
Yeah, that's about all I can handle. The book, the program, my clients, you know, my current set of clients. I help people with sort of whatever comes up for them. You know, so I think of sober coaching as they are the kite and I am the string. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in the beginning of the process, they tell me what their goals and values are. And then as they sort of go through the process, you know, a kite needs to be able to move around and go up and down and do all the stuff. And I'm just there to hold them, to be grounded, you know, to, as they progress and go through things and help them to process through things and help them, you know, I feel like all the answers are inside you anyway. And so really my job is just to hold some safe boundaries and keep you grounded. I'm sort of like a resource coordinator. You know, there are lots of things that are outside my scope as a coach. You know, so I will send people to go get trauma therapy. I will send people to 12-step meetings, and I can typically continue to work with them because it's nice to have one person who has like the full scope of the story and the full scope of everything that's happening.
What have been some of your favorite podcast episodes lately from your podcast?
Well, not to be totally self-serving, but to be self-serving, my friend Charlie came on to act as the host on my own
podcast. Interview you.
Mm-hmm. He did, because I had some people being like, you know, maybe you should talk about why you wrote the book. And I'm not one of those people who's great at solo content. Mm-hmm. Right? Some people are really good at, you have such a talent for like the solo, the entertaining, educational, you're fucking hilarious. I love all your stuff. People really resonate with that. I'm not good at that. Maybe I need to practice. Anyway, invited Charlie on. And so he has such a depth of knowledge of 12-step in general and of recovery, because he and I are sort of in the same camp of there are many paths, mm-hmm. but I'm just saying, this is, do all your work and try the 12 steps. It's literally like an and thing. It's not this or that, but it's like, mm-hmm. and so
just give it a go.
Yeah, we had a good time. So that was a lot of fun.
Good. I'll put a link to that in the show notes. So, this was a pleasure.
I'm so glad that we got a chance to hang out, and I can't wait to have you on mine.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.